Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening's program. Gary Taubes is the author of Bad Science and Nobel Dreams, Good Calories and Bad Calories, and is a correspondent for Science Magazine. The only print journalist to have won 3 Science and Society Journalism Awards given by the National Association of Science Writers, he has contributed to articles in the Best American Science Writing 2002 and the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2000 and 2003. He was born in Rochester, New York, studied applied physics at Harvard and aerospace engineering in Stanford, and received his master's degree in journalism at Columbia University in 1981. He is independent health policy investigator at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just a brief background. Yeah, I'm a journalist. I'm not a doctor. I came out today. I looked like a doctor outfit so that people would take me seriously. I've been reporting and writing on controversial science for roughly 25 years. And on about early 90s, some of my friends in the physics community suggested I look into the science and public health because they said it was so bad that I would never run out of things to write about. So I've spent the last, 17 years writing mostly about public health and the last 10 writing about diet. And in 2002, I got a significant book advance to write this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and it paid for basically 4 years of my life to research and write the book, and I spent 5 years because that's what writers do. And it gave me an opportunity, in effect, to read all the literature and all the relevant literature on nutrition and chronic disease going back to the 19th century. You know, because of the internet, I could actually locate it. I had at one point 5 different students going to different libraries in New York, Boston, and Los Angeles, Xeroxing whatever articles or books I couldn't find on the internet or buy and use bookstores. So the end result is this lecture, Why We Get Fat, Adiposity 101, and the Alternative Hypothesis of Obesity. And what I want to convince you today is something that Patty told me before she started. She said weight loss is all about common sense, right? We all know this. You've got to exercise and eat your vegetables and eat less and you'll be lean and healthy. And I'm going to try and convince you that that's nonsense. It's not that it's not about common sense, but the common sense that we're using happens to be incorrect. And the only relevance to the introduction that Patty gave that I studied applied physics at Harvard because I'm going to talk a little bit about the laws of thermodynamics. And one point in my life, the high point of my life to date was being on the Larry King show and getting a lecture in thermodynamics from Jillian Michaels, you know, the trainer on the Biggest Loser show. And I was speechless. I couldn't even respond. Who can say that? Anyway, so let's talk about that. Just a little context. You know, there's an obesity epidemic going on. We're getting fatter and basically, the epidemic starts, these are various nutrition and health surveys, and the epidemic starts somewhere between this NHANES 2 and NHANES 3, and you can see this upturn. That's what we're talking about. We're up to now, at the peak, 34% of the country was described as clinically obese. And there's a diabetes epidemic that goes along with it. So diabetes diagnoses have more than tripled since 1980. And, you know, we want to know why, but not with this slide. That worked in Boston. I gave this talk in Boston last week, and it worked. Okay, so why do we get fat? That's what we want to know. That's the what's going on here? And we all have this hypothesis. Technically, it's the energy balance hypothesis of obesity, but we eat too much. You know, we take in more calories than we consume, and the excess is stored as fat. Often you'll see, you know, people say it's all calories in, calories out. If you reduce the calories in and increase the calories out, you'll get lean again, okay? So that's a conventional wisdom. Here's the official version. You know, U.S. Surgeon General says overweight is a result of caloric imbalance, too few calories expended for the amount of calories consumed. The NIH says obesity occurs when a person consumes more calories from food than he or she burns. And because this is our idea for what causes obesity, we also want to know what causes the obesity epidemic. You know, I approach this from the perspective of a real science. And in science, what you have are observations, and you want to explain the observations. So one of the observations is the obesity epidemic, and how do you explain it with this calories in, calories out idea? And basically, as Marion Nestle, a nutritionist at the New York University, put it, you know, we've become more prosperous. Should improved prosperity cause the obesity epidemic? People use extra income to eat more and be less active. Kelly Brown now directs the Rudd Center for Food Policy at Yale, said we live in a toxic environment that encourages overeating and physical inactivity. And the way Kelly describes a toxic environment is like this. He says, cheeseburgers and french fries, drive-in windows and supersizes, soft drinks and candy, potato chips and cheese curls, once unusual, are as much our background as trees, grass, and clouds. Few children walk or bike to school. There's little physical education. Computers, video games, and television keep children inside and inactive, and parents are reluctant to let children roam free to play. Basically, you know, we eat too much. There's too much palatable food available, and we don't have enough opportunity to exercise. Virtually everything in our technology keeps us from exercising, and so we sit at our desk all day long, and our children sit in front of their TV and computers all day long, and this is why they get fat. And what you want to know is, this is a hypothesis, and can it explain the observations? So let's look at some of the observations. By the way, I realized when that one slide was screwed up on this projector, there's a high likelihood that a lot of them will be because I have some photos, so be prepared. This young lady right here is Fat Louisa. She's a Pima. The Pima Indians live in Arizona, south of Phoenix, and they're now known, they're like the poster children for obesity and diabetes in the United States. They have the highest rates of any population out there. But what isn't really, nobody really pays attention to, is that the Pima used to be the most affluent Native American tribe in the United States. In fact, they were hunters and gatherers and agriculturalists. They farmed, they raised, they had cattle and pigs. They raised corn and wheat. They ate the fruit of the saguaro cactus. They hunted in the fields. They got they fished and ate clams from the Gila River that ran through their reservation. And in 1846, when a U.S. Army battalion went through the Pima territory, the Army surgeon described the Pima as sprightly and in fine health. And he said they had the greatest abundance of food and take care of it well. They had warehouses full of food. And, in fact, so much so that after gold was discovered in California in 1849 and the Santa Fe Trail, which ran through the Pima Territory, took from 20 to 60,000, depending on estimates, travelers west, the 49ers, the U.S. government asked the Pima to help feed them on the way, and they did. Then what happens is the Anglo-Americans and Mexicans start moving into the Pima territory in the 1860s. They divert the Pima, the Gila River water, to irrigate their own fields. They overhunt the nearby mountains. And by the 1870s, the Pima are starving. And they go through 20 to 30 years of what they call the period of famine. And by 1901, 1902, when a Harvard anthropologist named Frank Russell comes to live with the tribe and write the definitive book on it, the Pima are living on a reservation, they're borderline starvation, and they have an obesity problem. Many old persons exhibit a degree of obesity, Russell writes, that is in striking contrast with the tall and sinewy Indian conventionalized in popular thought. It's Russell who took this picture of the Indian he called Fat Louisa. And what's interesting is they went from being affluent in the 1850s to through 30 years of famine. Basically, if you're starving to death for 30 years, you should be lean, right? And yet, in 1901, 1902, when they're on a reservation and barely scraping out a living, now you have an obesity problem. They've gone the opposite direction from what our hypothesis says. You know, what we do with hypotheses in science is we make predictions. Our hypothesis says that if you become affluent, you become obese. Here's a tribe that became impoverished and became obese. There are a lot of these studies. One of the things I did that the nutrition community hasn't done is actually gone back into the literature to look for examples of populations in which obesity rates were measured prior to the mid-1980s when this became obesity research became a sort of huge industry. So in 1928, a couple of economists from the University of Chicago go to visit the South Dakota Crow Creek Reservation to study the Sioux, and they report that the living conditions are sort of poverty beyond what we can imagine today. 1 to 2 room shacks, unfit for occupancy, 4 to 8 people live per room, 40% of the children on this reservation lives in homes without toilets, water is drawn from the river, 15 families with 32 children on this reservation are living chiefly on bread and water. And yet the obesity rates are not all that different than what we see today in the United States. 40% of the adult women, 25% of the men, and 10% of the children would be termed distinctly fat. 20% of the women, 25% of the men, and 25% of the children are extremely thin. So there's this combination that you can see in 1928 already of obesity in association with malnutrition and undernutrition in the same population. And we're going to come back to that because it's a key observation. So let's just look at some other populations that that you can find in the literature. 1959, African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, 18% of the men and 30% of the women were obese. Total family incomes of $9 to $53 a week. Again, these people are poor beyond what we are accustomed to imagining in this day and age. Zulus in Durban, South Africa, 40% of the women are obese, and women in their 40s averaged 175 pounds. I think the average weight of American women today with the obesity epidemic is 165 pounds. Trinidad, 1961-63. The Trinidad had a malnutrition problem. People were starving. The U.S. government sends a team of nutritionists down to help out, and they come back reporting that a third of the women over 25 are obese, that obesity is a potentially serious medical problem in women, and that the per capita daily diet is less than 2,000 calories per day, than 21% fat. That is fewer calories than the Food and Agriculture Organization were recommending at the time required for a healthy diet. Here's some more of these. Bantu pensioners in South Africa. These are described as the poorest of the poor in South Africa. The mean weight of women over 60 is 165 pounds. 30% of the women are severely overweight. Rarotonga in the South Pacific, 40% of the women are obese and 25% are described as grossly obese. And Chilean factory workers in 1974, 30% are obese, 10% suffer undernourishment. There's that combination again of obesity and malnutrition or undernutrition. Nearly 50%, half of the women over 54 were obese, and most were engaged in heavy labor. So they're not working out. They're not going for walks 45 minutes a day. They're not training for marathons, but they're involved in heavy labor in a factory in Chile, and I doubt very many of us could do that. I know I couldn't, and I've been a jock my whole life, and yet their obesity rates are as high as they are in the United States today. Mexican Americans in Starr County, Texas. This study was done by a fellow named William Mueller at the University of Texas Southwestern. He wanted to study heart disease in this population, which if this had come across, you would see the state of Texas here with Starr County right at the bottom on the border of Mexico. He reported that 50% of the women in their 50s were obese and 40% of the men in their 40s. And the living conditions, most inhabitants are employed in agriculture and labor and or work in the oil fields in the country. So these are hardworking people, regardless of whether or not they belong to health clubs. And there is one restaurant in Starr County in 1981, a Mexican restaurant. So the point is, these are populations in which there are no aspects of that toxic environment. There's virtually no food industry to seduce people into eating too much. You know, David Kessler, who's spoken here and used to be dean at UCSF, likes to talk about the overeating and what a huge problem it is because the food industry conditions us to overeat. These people are obese without a food industry. Okay, they were obese without keeping their children home from school. They were hardworking. They were poor, and yet they had high obesity rates. And you want to, this is the opposite of what our hypothesis predicts, and we want to know why. So why are these populations fat? 1960s, Ralph Richards was a diabetes specialist trained in England. He moved to Kingston, Jamaica. He set up a diabetes clinic at the University of the West Indies. He reported that 10% of the adult men and 2/3 of the adult women were obese. And this is what he said. He said, it's difficult to explain the high frequency of obesity seen in a relatively impecunious society such as exists in the West Indies when compared to the standard of living enjoyed in the more developed countries. He's saying just what I said. These people are so poor, they should be lean, right? You know, because our hypothesis is that affluence causes obesity, prosperity. He says, malnutrition and subnutrition are common disorders in the first 2 years of life in these areas and account for almost 25% of all admissions to pediatric wards in Jamaica. Subnutrition continues in early childhood to the early teens, and by subnutrition he means they don't get enough food, period. Obesity begins to manifest itself in the female population from the 25th year of life and reaches enormous proportions from 30 onward. Okay, that was an open mind. Now let's look at this very same observation being made 30 years later, with sort of couched in this belief we all have that it's all about calories in, calories out, eating too much. That's the paradigm. This comes from Benjamin Caballero, who's director of the Center for Human Nutrition at Johns Hopkins. In 2005, he writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, a pretty good journal, A Nutrition Paradox, Underweight and Obesity in Developing Countries. And he says, a few years ago, I was visiting a primary care clinic in the slums of Sao Paulo, Brazil. The waiting room was full of mothers with thin, stunted young children exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition. Their appearance, sadly, would surprise few who visit poor urban areas in the developing world. What might come as a surprise is that many of the mothers holding those undernourished infants were themselves overweight. And then he says, the coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to public health programs, since the aims of programs to reduce undernutrition, i.e. feed people more, are obviously in conflict with those for obesity prevention, i.e. feed people less. And I put this in italics because the coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to not public health programs, but to your fundamental beliefs, your paradigm. If you believe these mothers are obese because they ate too much, because they're sneaking outside to eat their Snickers bars while their kids are starving to death, then that goes against everything we know about maternal behavior, right? Mothers will starve themselves to death to make sure their children get proper food. That's what my mother would have done, or at least what she told me she would have done. Can't have it both ways. If we actually believe that the mothers got fat by eating superfluous calories, why didn't they just give those calories to their kids so they wouldn't be undernourished, thin, and stunted? Okay, it poses a challenge to your paradigms, and in my honor of my mother who passed away 20-odd years ago, I'm going to throw out the obesity paradigm and keep the maternal paradigm intact. Here's some other inconvenient facts, okay? Things, observations that we ignore when we blithely assume that it's all about overeating. The first one is that calorie-restricted, undereating doesn't work. Okay, overeating works. Calorie-restricted diets, if you actually look in the literature for how well these work to cure obesity, and I always go to the Cochrane Collaboration because this was a collaboration that was founded about 20 years ago to do unbiased reviews of medical interventions, since most physicians like to do biased reviews. And when they're describing calorie-restricted diets, meaning eating less, they say weight loss achieved in clinical trials is so small as to be clinically insignificant. And what happens with this observation is you get these bizarre inconsistencies in the literature. You know, everybody knows that telling people to eat less doesn't work. But it's, as the Handbook of Obesity says in 1998, this was edited by three of the most prestigious names in the field, dietary therapy remains a cornerstone of treatment, and the reduction of energy intake, eating less, continues to be the basis of successful weight reduction programs. And then down below, a couple paragraphs later, it says the result of dietary therapy, quote, are known to be poor and not long-lasting. So why is it the cornerstone if telling people to eat less doesn't work? And how could any intelligent person write that without wondering what was going on? So the question is, should this come as a surprise that eating less doesn't work? And Hilda Brook, who was a leading expert on childhood obesity in the United States in the mid-20th century and in some ways is my hero, Hilda Brook put it this way. She said, more than in any other illness, the physician treating the obese patient is called upon only to do a special trick, to make the patient do something, stop eating after it has already been proved that he cannot do it. Everybody knows that the solution to weight gain is to eat less. If you are overweight or obese, you've already proven that you can't do it. So what's going on? Here's a second inconvenient fact. The efficacy of exercise, because eating less works so poorly, we often say, well, now we've just shifted the thing and said, okay, we can't get people to make their intake smaller. Let's get them to increase their expenditure. Chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, even cancer that are known to associate with obesity are now considered diseases of sedentary behavior because as people get fatter because they're sedentary, that then causes obesity, you know, diabetes, heart disease. Okay, so I could quote you meta-analyses on this. By the way, I'm only talking so fast, not because I'm trying to sell you something, although I am trying to sell you something, but I have a lot of slides. Normally this talk takes about an hour and 10 minutes. I'm going to try and condense it down so there's time for questions in 50 minutes. I always fail. I always say that, and I always fail. 2007, The American Heart Association, the American College of Sports Medicine come out with physical activity guidelines. These are people who want us to exercise. They believe, as I do, that exercise is a fundamental aspect of a healthy lifestyle. They would be tempted to tilt, you know, to spin it to make the data as compelling as possible. And this is what they say about the efficacy of exercise as a weight loss tool. They say it's reasonable to assume that persons with relatively high daily energy expenditure would be less likely to gain weight over time compared with those who have low energy expenditures. So marathoners should be less likely to gain weight over time compared. Actually, that's a poor way to put it. Let me rephrase this. Another way to rephrase this is to say it's reasonable to assume that persons couch potatoes who have low energy expenditure and increase it so they have high energy expenditure would be less likely to gain weight over time than if they remain couch potatoes. And so far, data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. Okay? It's not, the data are not particularly compelling that if you increase your energy expenditure, you will lose weight or be less likely to gain it. And what's interesting about this hypothesis is it's over 100 years old. Okay, I mean, you could date it easily to the 1880s, 1890s, when the laws of thermodynamics were first shown to hold for animate objects as well as inanimate. I could date it to the 1860s when an obese British undertaker named William Banting wrote a book and discussed how one of his friends was a doctor and said, go out and row 2 hours a day, and if you row 2 hours a day, you'll lose weight, and he didn't. He just got hungrier and gained weight. If a hypothesis is 100 years old, and the best you could say about it is the data to support this are not particularly compelling. The point is, it's not that it's wrong. It might be right. But you should at least seriously consider the possibility that it is wrong. Okay? Because we've thrown money at this problem for a century, and we still can't make it any so that we could say the data are compelling. Here's the third inconvenient fact, the accuracy required to practice energy balance. We talk about this a lot now. This is a new phrase you hear. There are foundations that have been founded, usually by the food industry, that want to teach us how to practice energy balance, which means to balance the calories we take in to the calories we expend. What you want to know is how well do you have to do that in order to at least maintain your weight, if not gain it. And so let's just assume this average between men and women, say you eat about 2,700 calories a day. That's about 1 million calories a year, 10 million calories over a decade. It's 12 tons of food every decade. If you want to maintain your weight to within 10 pounds over the course of that decade, you have to make sure that you do not overeat every day an average of 11 calories too much. You need an accuracy better than 0.4%. If you eat 11 calories too much over the course of a decade, you'll gain 10 pounds, you'll gain 20 pounds over 20 years, 40 pounds over 40 years, you'll be going from a lean 25-year-old to an obese 65-year-old, just by erring on the side of overeating by 11 calories a day. If it's, say, 22 calories a day, you'll gain 20 pounds a decade. 33 calories, you'll gain 30 pounds a decade. Get back here. The point is, nobody can do this. Nobody can do this. We can't. The best person in the world at counting calories can't judge the calories he consumes to within 11 calories a day. And we basically have no idea how much we're expending. We might go running one day and say, I just expended 300 calories more. But I'm not going to say I expended 311 calories more, so now I'm expending 1,457 when yesterday I was expending, you know, blah, blah, blah. Animals don't do it. They can't consciously judge how many calories they expend. They just don't gain weight, no matter whether, you know, they eat all day long and they walk around. In the East, we have deer infestations. You know, when you have a lot of food available and no predators, you don't get fatter deer, you get more deer. This calculation was done prior to the Second World War. It showed up in a Basal Metabolism and Health and Disease, which was a seminal nutrition and metabolism textbook pre-World War II. The author was Eugene Dubois, who was the leading authority in the field, and he did this calculation, and he said, this is weird. He said, there's no stranger phenomenon than the maintenance of constant body weight under marked variation in bodily activity and food consumption. If what you have to do to maintain your weight, just not gain 10 pounds as balance calories into calories out, to better than 11 calories a day. The question is not why some of us get fat, but how any of us stay lean. How do any of us stay lean if this is what we're supposed to be doing? And we're used to thinking that people who eat in moderation can do it, and people who gain weight easily can't. But you're not counting calories to within 11 calories a day. And if you just, one way to do it is just say, let's just eat less. Do what Michael Pollan recommends and eat not too much. So I'm going to leave a couple hundred calories on the plate every day, assuming that if I ate it all, that would be balanced, and now I'm going to eat less. But then why don't we end up emaciated? Because if you err on the opposite side of under-eating by a couple hundred calories a day, shouldn't we all end up skin and bones? So shouldn't we be at the extremes of the you know, it's a troublesome number. How about genetics? You know, we all know that obesity runs in families. It's a genetic trait. That was actually first shown in the 1930s, although for, you know, obesity researcher publishes a study today saying that he'll get in the newspapers. Here's what I'm going to do now is I'm actually channeling pre-World War II European researchers. And some of these photos come from the pre-World War II European obesity books, and you don't find photos of naked human beings in modern textbooks. Occasionally you'll find photos of fat rats, but these pre-World War II clinicians thought that you could learn a lot by studying how people get fat, not just whether they do or not, because we get fat in different ways, and it's interesting. So, for instance, here's a lean pair of identical twins, and here's an obese pair of identical twins, and our calories in, calorie, we might say, well, okay, these people, these two overate, and these didn't. Okay, so our hypothesis says something about this relationship. They ate too much and were sedentary. But what about this relationship? I mean, did they eat, did their genes code for them to eat exactly the same amount of calories in excess and to do exactly the same amount of sedentary behavior every day? What's going on? Why do they have the exact same body type? And we know, you know, identical twins, they don't all look perfectly exactly alike, but it's not just their faces that look alike. Their bodies look alike. If they're heavy, they're both heavy. If they're thin, they're both heavy. What are their genes coding for? Is it their propensity to eat too much, to go to McDonald's? Here's a variation on an animal husbandry, variation on a theme. This is a, you know, we've been breeding animals to be more or less fatty for hundreds of years. This is an Aberdeen Angus. It's a particularly fatty breed of cattle, very stocky, and you get this intramuscular, here's the meat, you get this intramuscular fat. And here's a Jersey cattle, and it's a lean cow. You can see the ribs here. It's a dairy cow. So the question is, when you're breeding for an Aberdeen Angus over dairy, are you breeding for, does this animal take bigger bites when it you know, grazes? Does it graze for 14 hours a day when the dairy only grazes for 13? Does this guy go for runs at night when no one's looking, like that famous Far Side cartoon, you know? It's like this guy goes inside the barn and turns on the TV. I mean, it's absurd, right? What you're probably breeding for is some quality of the meat, the propensity for the fat deposition and muscle deposition itself. And one way to think about it is this woman is a dairy cattle, this is cow. And so basically you have a machine that takes in calories and produces milk, and you don't want those calories going anywhere else than the milk. You don't want to waste them bulking this guy up like the Aberdeen Angus. So you're kind of directing where the calories go. It's very energy expensive creating milk. So he takes in cattle. The genes probably determine how the fuel is partitioned. That's a phrase you hear. And in the Aberdeen Angus, you get the same thing, but the fuel is partitioned to creating protein and fat, not milk. So you can see just by looking at cattle, we're probably not talking about how much these cattle want to eat and exercise. Sexual variations. Okay, here's another problem that the pre-World War II Europeans cared about and modern obesity researchers don't. Men tend to get fat above the waist. Women tend to get fat below the waist. Interestingly enough, men also get fat below the waist. So if you have a man who weighs, say, 270 pounds and he's obese, but his weight is above his waist, it's increased his risk of heart disease twofold. If it's below the waist, it hasn't. Even though they weigh the exact same amount, you could assume they overate to the same amount. So you might say to yourself, what do calories have to do with it? But what do you know? Obviously, there are genetic variations in where we put on fat. So sex hormones are somehow determining this propensity. And if you think about it in puberty, when men and women start off in puberty, they have about the same amount of body fat, about 6-7%. And by the time they're done puberty, the man has grown larger, lost fat, and put on muscle, and the girl has put on fat and has 50% more body fat now than the man does. So they've both gotten bigger. They've both taken in more calories than they've expended, right? And yet the boy has gotten muscular and the girl has put on fat. And she's put on fat in very specific places, you know, designed more or less evolutionarily to drive the boys crazy. What is the fact that they both overate have to do with it? That's the question. I'm just trying to get you to think of this in a different way. Here's a tricky one, progressive lipodystrophy. This is there are about 200 cases of this disorder in the literature by the 1950s, mostly in women. In these cases, I feel like, okay, I'm gonna, Starbucks is gonna fund this if I point my Starbucks cup outward. In these women, they start to lose fat in their face, and it moves downwards. They lose all the subcutaneous fat, and then it moves down. One British physician measured one of his cases and moved down at about the rate of an inch a year. And then it usually stops just above the waist, and they get what's called lower body obesity, often below the waist. It's progressive because of this movement of the fat. It doesn't happen all at once. And what these pre-World War II Europeans said is, look, are we going to blame the top half on undereating and the bottom half on overeating? And this is obviously absurd, right? But if this woman had, say, 10 pounds more fat on her upper body, I mean, she actually is clinically obese. I know the numbers, her BMI is around 32. But if she had 10 more pounds on the upper body, she wouldn't have a lipodystrophy. She'd just be obese, and you'd say exercise more and eat less. When you look at it this way, you know, well, something else is going on here that's got nothing to do with how much they're eating. Here's a modern version of it, lipodystrophy in HIV-infected patients. It's apparently caused by the antiretroviral therapies that you get when you're HIV-infected. And you see the same loss of subcutaneous fat in the face and elsewhere. They lose fat on the buttocks and the legs. They put on fat in specific places, often this pot belly right here, there's a fat on the back of the neck, a buffalo hump. And these two photos were taken 4 months apart. This was prior to beginning antiretroviral therapy and after antiretroviral therapy. And you could see that if this patient came into the doctor and the doctor didn't know anything about his history, the doctor would say, well, you got to stop drinking beer and get to the gym, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's absolutely no doubt this guy was going to the gym. So there's a pretty good chance that his pot belly was not caused by overeating. And if his wasn't, why should we assume ours was? So now, why do we believe this? And the reason we believe it is the laws of thermodynamics. That's where it comes from. You often see, I told you I got a lecture from Jillian Michaels that I don't understand the laws of thermodynamics. First law of thermodynamics is the one that people care about. It says it's energy conservation. It basically says if the energy of a system changes, delta means the change, the energy, E, then the energy that goes into it has to be greater than the energy that goes out of it, okay? You could think of it as a change in fat mass is equal to energy consumed minus energy expended, right? So if we take in more energy than we expend, we have to get fatter. And if we expend more energy than we take in, we have to get leaner. Okay, so people take this and they say, that means if you take in more energy than you expend, you will get fatter, and therefore taking in more energy than you expend is the cause of obesity. That is the logic that's happening here. It's been going on for 50 years. The problem is there is no arrow of causality in this equation. There's no causal information in the laws of thermodynamics. This is a mistake at the level of like junior high school science, except junior high school science teachers make it. I mean, it's almost bizarre that this has continued for 50 years, and I can think of two researchers in the country who pointed this out prior to my book coming out. And I only figured it out because a 1950s researcher wrote several papers about it. There's no causal information in the laws of thermodynamics. What it says is if you get fatter, you have to take in more calories than you expend because we can't just make energy from nothing. Energy is consumed. It doesn't say why you get fatter, and it doesn't say why you take in more energy than you expend. It just says it has to happen. It describes a state of the universe that we no longer question. The laws of thermodynamics are inviolate. It doesn't tell you anything about cause. And one way to think about it, like let's say you wanted to know, somebody out there wanted to know why this room is so crowded. Okay, this room, you know, it's full of energy, just like fat tissue is full of energy, people are energy. So we want to know, why is this room so crowded? So they come in here and they say to me, hey, why is this room so crowded? And I say, well, because more people entered than left. That's the equivalent to saying you get fat because you eat more than you expend. And then the person says, well, wait, that's idiotic. Of course more people entered than left, right? Otherwise it wouldn't be crowded. But why is it so crowded? And I say, well, because if more people enter than leave, it has to get crowded. And you can think I'm an idiot or a wise ass, basically. That's exactly what's happening when your doctor says you get fat because you take in more calories than you expend. If you take in more calories than you expend, you have to get fatter or get bigger. And if you get bigger, you have to take in more calories than you expend. That's all the laws of thermodynamics say. They say nothing about the fundamental cause of either of those. There's another problem which is what happens when your doctor says you can lose weight by eating less or exercising more. This is a no arrow of causality problem. The assumption is that if your doctor says, okay, look, if you start exercising, you'll increase energy out, and if you don't eat anymore, you see this all the time, if you keep the calories the same but go for a run every day, you'll lose weight. Okay? And the assumption is that energy in and energy out are not, they're what mathematicians would call independent variables. They have nothing biologically to do with each other, okay? So the idea is, again, you know, if they tell you to eat less and keep your expenditure the same, or maybe eat less and increase your expenditure, you got to lose weight. But the problem is E in and E out are dependent variables. And the best example of that is this idea that you could lose weight by exercising. Remember there used to be a notion called working up an appetite? How many people remember the idea of working up an appetite, okay? You go and you play 18 holes of golf or you go for a long walk and you get hungrier. If you expend energy, you get hungrier. And if you are sedentary for a long time, actually your appetite will go down a little bit because you're not expending energy. Our bodies will match energy into energy out. And a good way to put it, Jeff Flier is now dean of Harvard Medical School. He's a obesity researcher, and his wife, Terry Maritos Flier, wrote this article in Scientific American in 2007. And they put it this way. An animal whose food is suddenly restricted, okay, so you reduce energy in, tends to reduce its energy expenditure both by being less active and by slowing energy use in cells, thereby limiting weight loss. It also experiences increased hunger, so that once the restriction ends, it'll eat more than its prior norm until the earlier weight is attained. So if you tell an animal to eat less, well, you can't tell it to because it won't listen to you. If you restrict how much it eats, it will actually, not only will it be less active, it will expend less energy. And what's interesting is, I don't know why the Flyers didn't say a person, because the same has been shown in people since 1917. When people are starving, not only does their body temperature drop and they're cold all the time, people who calorie restrict because they think it's going to make them live longer wear heavy thermal overwear because they can't generate enough body heat, they're less active. They have less of what these pre-World War II researchers would call the impulse to physical activity. And the same goes if you energy, again, if you increase energy out, you get hungrier, you work up an appetite. So what I want to do and what is just basically give you a different way to think about it now. I've told you the problems with all these with this energy in, energy out, overeating hypothesis. Let's have a solution. Do you have a question or are you just... Okay. This is the way my European pre-World War II Germans and Austrians thought about it. They didn't say, like, if you look in obesity literature, you'll see this line, obesity is a disorder of energy balance. That means overeating. They said obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation, which sounds so simple. It's such first principles that it's almost meaning, like, obesity is a disorder of having too much fat is a disorder of having too much fat. But if you ask that question, the first thing you should ask after that is what regulates your fat tissue. They said, so it's not energy balance, it's not overeating, it's not sedentary behavior, it's obesity is sort of excess fat accumulation. And the primary defect is probably in the body, not the brain, because that's where the fat is, okay? Our fat tissue is probably regulated incorrectly. And then overeating and inactivity are compensatory effects. They are not causes. And the way this was said to me the first time I heard it was, we don't get fat because we overeat. We overeat because our fat tissue is accumulating excess fat. Remember, what the laws of thermodynamics tell us is if we get bigger, we have to take in more calories than we expend. So if I create a magic drug and I inject it into you and you start expanding, you're either going to get very hungry or very sedentary because you're getting bigger. So here's the analogy. Oh, and this is such a shame. A growing child. What I had here that you can't see was a photo of this adorable former New Yorker when he was 1 year old and weighed 20 pounds. And here he is, 3 years older, he's 4 years old and he weighs 45 pounds. So again, I mean, it's a shame you can't see that picture because he was really cute, not that I know him. He had gained 25 pounds in 3 years. He overate. He had to have overeaten. He took in more calories than he expended. He was in positive energy balance. He was growing. But nobody would say this child grew because he overate, right? He overate because he was growing. He was secreting growth hormone. That made him grow. And as he grew, he was had a voracious appetite. Kids go through growth spurts. We all know this. They have voracious appetites. They often sit around all day long. Here's another way. Another way to think about it, this would have been the photo of the world's tallest man and a photo of the world's fattest man. The world's tallest man was Robert Wadlow. He weighed 8'11". He was about 500 pounds when he died at 22 years old. I mean, he was 8'11" tall, okay, and he was 500 pounds. He was in positive energy balance his whole life, right? Probably, he was, because if he continued growing, and 500 pounds, if he was only 5'11", he'd be massively obese. Luckily, he was 8'11", so he was a beanpole. But the point is, that person, if he walked into a doctor's office today, they'd lay him down the MRI machine, they'd scope his brain, they'd find the tumor in his, I always forget which hormone, that's causing him to secrete excess growth hormone, and they take it out, and luckily if they catch it young enough, they'll stop his growth. If the world's fattest man walks into the office, they say exercise more, you know, and eat less. And it's an interesting thing. If you think about two children, say they're both 12 years old, one is 6'10" and weighs 220 pounds, and one is 5'10" and weighs 220 pounds. They both go to a doctor. The one who's 6'10" and 220 pounds is going to get the scan looking for the growth hormone before he grows to 8 feet tall. The one who's 5'10 and weighs 220 is going to get the lecture, and his parents might get put in jail for not, you know, abusing him and not knowing how to feed him correctly, and yet they both overate for their whole lives. Tumors, you know, tumors grow. This is a great photo of a tumor. Here it is, and it's getting bigger and bigger. They're in positive energy balance. They're taking in more energy than they expend, but we don't care. We just want to know, why is that tumor growing? Because we know if it's growing, it's in positive energy balance. So here's the alternative hypothesis. It was called lipophilia. That means love of fat. And it was a German-Austrian hypothesis. It was first put forth by Gustav von Bergmann in 1908. Von Bergmann was a leading expert on internal medicine in Germany. And today, the German Society of Internal Medicine, one of their highest honors is the Gustav von Bergmann Medal. Julius Bauer was a very famous geneticist and endocrinologist at the University of Austria. By 1940, it was more or less fully accepted in Europe. The problem is 1940 was a bad year for Europe, okay, one of many during that period. So by the end of World War II, this hypothesis had vanished. And it's worth noting that the best medical research in the world, virtually the only meaningful medical research in the world prior to World War II, was going on in Europe. In fact, when I used to write about physics when I started my career, the physicists would say, best thing that ever happened to American science was Hitler, because he chased all these brilliant physicists over to the United States, and we embraced them because we were building nuclear weapons and we were competing with the Russians and we needed them. We didn't need these people, and we did not embrace them. So Julius Bauer, for instance, ended up writing papers with the living in Hollywood, California, and the papers would just identify him as Hollywood, California. And you could talk to geneticists in Europe today, in Austria, who still remember Julius Bauer and his work. His son actually went on to be dean of the USC Medical School, but nobody took these people seriously after the Second World War. And they didn't take the hypothesis seriously, and they didn't read the literature, because we didn't care what the Germans thought after the Second World War. It was just bad taste to care. So basically, this hypothesis was based on clinical observations, and the idea that lipophilia, those constitutionally predisposed to put on fat, have adipose tissue that's fat, it's more lipophilic than the constitutionally lean. And a metaphor, a way to think about it, is hair growth. You know, we put on hair in some places and not in others, you know, on the top of head and elsewhere. And some people are hairier than others. And just as we put on fat in some places, you know, in our guts and under our chins, but we don't put it on our foreheads or the back of our hands, and some people are fatter than others. And all of that is regulated. And it's regulated for a reason. It's regulated by hormones and by enzymes and by the central nervous system. And we want to know why. And this is how Bauer described it. He said, like a malignant tumor, like the fetus, the uterus, or the breasts of a pregnant woman, the abnormal lipophilic tissue seizes on foodstuffs, even in the case of undernutrition. It maintains its stock and may increase it independent of the requirements of the organism. A sort of anarchy exists. The adipose tissue lives for itself and does not fit into the precisely regulated management of the whole organism. The fat tissue is misregulated. It's taking more than it should take, and we want to know why. So one of the things you could do, I had a wonderful picture of a very fat rat here, is you could look at animal models of obesity and just say to yourself, if we look at animal models, there are a lot of different ways you can make animals obese. Are we making them obese by causing them to eat too much? or are we doing something fundamental to their fat tissue? And I'll use overectomized rats as the best example. This was one of the tipping points in my research, the epiphanies. I was talking to a guy at University of Massachusetts named George Wade, who studies animal reproduction. And animals, female animals, when they get pregnant, put on fat just like female humans do, and he wanted to know why. So you remove the ovaries from some of these rats, and what you notice afterwards is that they eat voraciously and get obese, okay? So this eating of voraciously is called hyperphagia. And it confirms your preconceptions. If I take away estrogen, because that's what I'm doing by removing the ovaries, the animal gets this voracious appetite. It eats too much. It's just like all those gluttons out there, and that's why it gets obese. But then what Wade did is he did the same experiment, and he controlled for overeating. Okay, what I mean by that is he wouldn't let these animals eat any more than they did when they were lean. So you do the surgery, you remove the ovaries, and now you put them on a diet. So they can't express this overeating hyperphagia, and they get just as fat just as quickly. And what they do now is they become completely sedentary, and their body temperature drops. And it's as though if you did the second experiment, say, hey, when I remove estrogen, the animal becomes a couch potato. And I also confirm my hypothesis. But when you do both, what you realize is by removing the estrogen, you fundamentally dysregulate this animal's fat tissue. It starts expanding with calories, with fat. And the animal has to compensate because it's losing. It's like you've got a spigot taking calories from its gut and shoving it right into the fat tissue, and the animal now has to replace those calories. So it's either got to eat more, and if it can't eat more, the second experiment, then it's more sedentary. And what Wade said to me, I mean, you can actually explain it. On the fat tissue is a hormone called lipoprotein lipase, and estrogen suppresses lipoprotein lipase. Lipoprotein lipase is called LPL, and what it does is pull fat into the fat tissue, simplistically. So when you have a lot of LPL, you pull a lot of fat from the bloodstream into the fat tissue. When you have little LPL, you pull a little fat. And estrogen suppresses LPL. You remove the estrogen, the LPL upregulates on the fat tissue. It starts pulling fat into the animal's fat tissue, and the animal has to compensate. This is also the reason why women, when they have hysterectomies or they go through menopause, tend to gain weight because they lose the estrogen that's suppressing LPL on the fat tissue. Every single one of these animal models of obesity, VMH lesioned animals, you can lesion a part of the brain called the ventromedial hypothalamus, the animal grow obese. You could do genetic experiments, genetic models. You could look at hibernators, and you could take hibernators when they emerge from hibernation in the springtime and restrict their calories so they can't increase their appetite, and they'll still get fat by the fall, extremely fat. Whether or not, and if they, whoa, let's get rid of that. So every model of obesity that I've ever found, and every time I interview a researcher, I ask them about it, can be divided into two groups. Those that this is true and that the intervention, the lesion to the brain, the genetic defect, whatever, makes the animal accumulate excess fat, are those in which the researcher never thought to look because it never crossed his mind that the animal was getting fatter for any other reason other than overeating. Jean Maillard was a leading nutritionist in the country in the 1960s in the world, studied a strain of genetic mice that got obese, and it was in their genes, and he said, these mice will make fat out of their food under the most unlikely circumstances, even when half starved. And right now you could start seeing the answer to that question about the women in these, you know, impoverished populations with this half-starved children. They may be making fat out of their food even when they're half-starved and their children are just half-starved. So a few seemingly obvious questions. You know, why vertical growth but not horizontal when we're talking about whether overeating is cause or effect? Why animals but not man? And if obesity is the sort of excess fat accumulation, which nobody would deny, what regulates fat accumulation? And let's talk about that. This science has been worked out since the 1920s. The hardest part about writing my book was that it was beautiful science, and I love science. And some very brilliant researchers did some very clever, wonderful experiments, and it's completely ignored. Anytime somebody says to you obesity is caused by eating too much, they are ignoring almost 100 years, or let's say 60 years, of beautiful research on the hormonal and enzymatic regulation of fat tissue. And I won't go through the history because I'm sure I'm running very long, but let's just get to the key thing you need to know why you get fat. There are two forms that fat takes in the human body that we're interested in, triglycerides and fatty acids. Triglycerides are three fatty acids bound together by a glycerol molecule. We store fat as triglycerides in our fat cells, and the reason we do is because triglycerides are too big to get in and out of the cell membrane. So it's literally like, you know, if you want to store fat, it's like you got to take the triglyceride apart on one side, move the component fatty acids into the fat cell, and rebuild the triglyceride on the other side. It's just like you do when you buy a piece of furniture and you find out it's not going to fit in the room you bought it for, you know. We burn fatty acids for fuel because the fatty acids can flow across not just the fat cell membranes, but the lean cell, the muscle membranes. Fat enters and exits the cells as fatty acids, and inside the fat cell, there's this constant cycling of these fatty acids into triglycerides and back again. And this was a great diagram right here in which you can see this fatty acid triglyceride cycle inside the fat cell. Here's the membrane of the fat cell, and inside, fatty acids are moving in and out across the membrane, and inside, you've got the cycling of fatty acids into triglycerides and back again. And the key is, anything that works to break a triglyceride into fatty acids, and so the fatty acids can escape the fat cell, will work to decrease the amount of fat in your fat cell. And anything that works to put more fatty acids into the fat cell and bind them together in triglycerides will work to make you store more fatty acids. And let's keep our hopes up. Ah, not too bad. So the question is, what regulates this? And here's our fat cell membrane, and here's our, this is the formation of the triglyceride. So basically, this is asking the question, this is from a 1973 metabolism textbook, basically, what hormones regulate this accumulation of fat in the fat cells? And what hormones do, think of it simplistically, is they tell our bodies to do something, you know, reproduce, fight or flight, grow. And when doing that, they also tell our body they make fuel available for our bodies so that they can do these things the hormones are telling us to do. They have these dual purposes. So virtually every hormone, growth hormone, adrenaline, noradrenaline, glucagon, virtually everyone works to increase the breakdown of triglycerides into these, this is non-esterified fatty acids, we'll just call them fatty acids. One hormone fundamentally works to put fat in the fat tissue, and that's insulin. Unfortunately, none of this could be worked out until the early 1960s because the technology to measure hormones in the bloodstream wasn't invented by Rosalind Yalom and Solomon Burson until 1959, 1960. As soon as they did, we knew that insulin was the primary regulator of fat metabolism. And if you want to get fat out of the fat cells, as Yalom and Burson said in 1965, it requires only the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. If you lower insulin levels, fat will come out of the fat cells. And if you raise insulin levels, fat goes into the fat cells. This is how the American Medical Association put it in 1974. Fat is mobilized from fat tissue when insulin secretion diminishes. So basically what it means, I'm going to skip all that and move to this. Insulin is a hormone that works to store fuels. It's a storage hormone, and it stores protein in our muscle cells, and it stores carbohydrates as glycogen in our liver cells. In our fat, it stores fat cells. And nobody doubts this, okay? And it's you know, well, that's not true. Some people and some bloggers doubt it, but if you look at the endocrinology textbooks, we're talking 1960s endocrinology, and you just look at, you know, insulin and fat storage. This is a 2001 textbook. It says the overall action of insulin on the adipocyte, that's a fat cell, is to stimulate fat storage and inhibit mobilization. And the remarkable effects of locally injected insulin on the accumulation of triglyceride fat into fat cells are graphically illustrated here. And this is a patient who developed type 1 diabetes mellitus in 1941 at the age of 17 years old. She injected herself daily over a period of some 47 years with approximately 60 units of insulin using only two injection sites on her thighs. And she ends up with these cantaloupe-sized masses of fat on her thighs. It's nothing to do with how much she ate or exercise, although that we know that if she gained weight while she put on this fat, she had to take in more calories than she expended. This is what insulin does to fat tissue. So the bottom line of what I call adiposity 101 is when insulin is secreted or chronically elevated, fat accumulates in the fat tissue. And when insulin levels drop, fat escapes from the fat tissue and the fat depots shrink, okay? And we secrete insulin primarily in response to the carbohydrates in our diet. Okay? This is where when I talk to doctors, I go, oh, he mentioned the word carbohydrates. He snuck up on us with that damn Atkins diet. Unfortunately, I did. George Cahill is emeritus professor at Harvard who, in 1965, he co-edited a 800-page American Physiological Society handbook on the science of fat metabolism. They put together this handbook because they wanted to take the wonderful research that had been done in the decade previously and make it available to everyone else. And this handbook included a lot of what I was talking about today. And the message, as George Cahill put it, is carbohydrate is driving insulin, it's driving fat. That's basically the simplest thing you have to know about obesity and overweight. And if you remove these sentences, these three words as driving insulin, you have carbohydrate as driving fat, which is logically equivalent. You know, a reasonable summary circa 1963, this was a 12-page article in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, by Edgar Gordon, who was a University of Wisconsin physiologist. And he explains this, and he says, thus an abundant supply of carbohydrate food exerts a powerful influence in directing the stream of glucose metabolism into lipogenesis, that's fat formation, whereas a relatively low carbohydrate intake levels leads to minimize the storage of fat. So the problem is, by the 1960s, basically, we have this beautiful science that begins in the 1920s. It's this theory of obesity developed by the European researchers that vanishes in the 1940s. After the World War II, obesity research is sort of reconstituted at the Harvard School of Nutrition. And an important thing is nutritionists don't treat patients. Okay, these nutritionists are studying rat models of disease, so they were unfettered by facts like obese people don't really lose weight when they eat less or exercise more. And the science catches up in the 1950s with these two major discoveries, a technique to measure fatty acids in the bloodstream and then this radioimmunoassay to measure insulin levels. And by 1965, it's clear that carbohydrates make you fat. Okay? And what happens is doctors read some of the same literature I did, and they say, hey, this suggests that if I cut the carbohydrates out of the diet and replace it with products that don't have carbs, which unfortunately are high-fat animal products, maybe I'll lose weight. And they lost weight effortlessly, and then they prescribed it to their patients, and they lost weight effortlessly, and then they wrote diet books about it that started to sell really well. And this was all happening at a period in time when we were beginning to believe that dietary fat caused heart disease. Okay? That was born in the 1950s, and by the 1960s, people were taking it very seriously. So if you eat a low-carb diet, if you remove the carbs and replace those calories with mostly fat, you're now eating a high-fat diet. So what happens is 1965, this didn't make it into my last book, it'll make it into my next one. The New York Times runs an article, July 7th, the same year that this American Physiological Society handbook comes out saying, in effect, carbohydrate is driving insulin, is driving fat. The New York Times has an article called New Diet Decried by Nutritionists, Dangers Are Seen in Low Carbohydrate Intake. It is a medical fact, they say, that no dieter can lose weight unless he cuts down on excess calories, either by taking in fewer of them or by burning them up in exercise. And we think we know today that this is a confusion of cause and effect. Because a diet sharply reduces carbohydrate, which makes up 45% of the average American's daily caloric intake, it naturally leads to a proportional or even quantitative increase in the intake of protein and fat. It is the fat increase that prompted Dr. Jean Mayer of Harvard to say that encouraging the diet for middle-aged Americans is, quote, in a sense equivalent to mass murder. Okay? So by the time we actually realize what it is that regulates fat tissue, and by the way, one thing I forgot to mention is that from 1825 until 1965, the conventional wisdom was that carbohydrates were fattening. That's what my mother grew up believing. Okay, bread, pasta, potatoes, rice, beer, you know, sweets, soft drinks, blah, 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 inherently fattening. They didn't know why, but if you ate them, you got fat. So then the research actually catches up to them and demonstrates, so we now know why these foods are fattening. And the nutritionists say if you put somebody on a low-carb diet and don't give them the fattening foods, it's the equivalent to mass murder because you'll raise their fat content and give them heart disease. 2 minutes. Here's the other place. When the calories in, calories out thing, and you could find this in virtually every textbook out there. This is a 2008 edition of Leninger's Principles of Biochemistry, which is the leading biochemistry textbook. And if you look up in the index what makes fat tissue fat, you'll find this. High blood glucose elicits the release of insulin, which speeds the uptake of glucose by tissues and favors the storage of fuels as glycogen and triglycerols while inhibiting fatty acid mobilization in adipose tissue. So you get high blood glucose from eating carbohydrates, and then you get insulin, which stores fat in the fat tissues and inhibits fatty acid. That's what makes fat tissues fat, carbohydrates and insulin. And if you look up what makes people fat, obesity, you see to a first approximation, obesity is a result of taking in more calories than are expended by the body's energy-consuming activities. So the explanation for what makes a fat cell fat is fundamentally different than the explanation for what makes a person fat, even though a person is just, in effect, the integration of all his fat cells. Here's just another example from William's textbook of endocrinology, which is the leading endocrinology textbook, says the same thing. Insulin makes a fat cell fat. People get fat because they overeat. Skip the clinical evidence and get to the summary because I have about 20 seconds. This is biology. It's not physics. Okay? And I don't know why it's been considered physics for 50 years, but it's not. It's biology. Obesity is a disorder of fat accumulation, not energy balance. Fat accumulation is regulated fundamentally by insulin and dietary carbohydrates, okay? As George Cahill said, carbohydrate is driving insulin, it's driving fat. Increasing fat accumulation will cause compensatory increases in energy intake and or decreases in expenditure. Gluttony and sloth are side effects of the dysregulation of the fat tissue caused by the effect of the carbohydrates we consume, particularly I'm not talking broccoli, okay? I am talking easily digestible carbs, basically anything made from bread or flour, starches. My mother did not believe that a potato was a vegetable, and neither do I. Sweets, liquid carbohydrates, beer, fruit juices, sodas. They're inherently fattening, and because they make us fatter, they make us want to eat more and expend less energy. And the only non-pharmaceutical remedy is to restrict or remove the causative agent, i.e. the carbohydrates. I think of it like cigarettes. You know, cigarettes cause lung cancer, but most people who smoke do not get lung cancer. But we never say, look, this guy's been smoking. Well, the tobacco industry does, but the rest of us don't say, because you didn't get lung cancer, that means cigarettes don't cause it. Those of us who get fat, for some huge percentage of us, we got fat because of the effect of the carbohydrates we eat on our insulin system in general. That's the thing. If the leanest we can be will be on the diet with the least carbohydrates, and certainly the healthiest we can be will be on the diet with the least of these fattening carbohydrates, the ones that specifically raise insulin or cause this disorder called insulin resistance. Anyway, thank you for your patience, and
our thanks to Gary Tobbs for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.